Okay, well, tonight our topic is the downfall of Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan and the rise of Yitzhak Rabin, 1974. So, last time we discussed the election of 1973, and I mentioned the point that although the election happened 2 months after the war, old entrenched patterns of voting did not yet go away completely, because not enough time had elapsed after the end of the hostilities for people to process who was guilty, who was responsible for this mechdal, for this failure. So that while there was a shift towards the right, the left still won and had to form a government. But that in the forming of the government, which takes a few months' time, the failures of the Yom Kippur were front and center, and it was fairly obvious that certain of the key ministers at the top of the food chain were hated by the general public, that a protest movement was brewing, and they wanted heads to roll. Now, in particular, one person stands out as the leader of the protest movement, Mati Ashkenazi. Who was Mati Ashkenazi? He was the head of the command at Budapest, which was the northernmost fort on the Barlev line, the only one that didn't get captured during the course of the war, and many of his men died in battle. He came back in February and stood outside the Prime Minister's residence with a sign from Budapest in protest. And another sign that said, Golda, your defense minister is a failure, and 3,000 of your grandchildren are dead. So this protest began as one man, then a few others followed, and a few others followed, till ultimately several thousand people camped outside both the Prime Minister's office and Prime Minister's residence, heckling, calling Dayan a murderer, every name in the book. So this was the uncomfortable social environment in which the political class has to try to reassemble a functioning government.
What was Mati Ashkenazi's political background?
None. He was just a plain old citizen who found himself at the center of attention because he started a movement.
Was he kibbutznik? I mean, what was he?
Offhand, I don't know. I don't know. But he was not politically involved. That's the most important thing. It's not as though he had a prior agenda where he was affiliated with a certain partisan group. Yeah, exactly. Definitely. So, Golda was the prime ministerial candidate of Labour. So it's her job to try to cobble together a 61-member coalition, at least. And she has trouble doing it because just the numbers aren't there. She has 51 of the alignment, 3 of the Arabs, and 4 of the independent liberals is 58, but she's got to get over the hump. She's got to get to the 61. Moreover, she has a problem that the Labour Party itself, the alignment is very much divided between the same old three wings that it's always had. Rafi on the right, the Mapai on the center, and Achdut HaAvodah on the left. And there's always the worry that one of these branches of the Labour alignment is going to run away from her and go into the opposition. So as the protests were mounting, Moshe Dayan made an announcement that he's not going to serve as defense minister in the upcoming cabinet. He refuses to do so. And he was encouraging a national unity government with the Likud, which Golda said will not happen because it'll be a government by paralysis, that there'll be no headway at all. Then, in loyalty to Moshe Dayan, the other leader of Rafi, Shimon Peres, also says he won't serve in the cabinet. So this is on March 3rd. To scare Dayan and Peres back into the fold, and because Golda needs them, lest she try to form a cabinet without Rafi and Rafi bolts away and goes to the opposition, she uses a ruse, a scare tactic. She says, okay, fine, Yitzhak Rabin will be the new defense minister. Knowing full well that Moshe Dayan will jump back into the job, not wanting to give it up and have Rabin, who he didn't get along very well with, as his boss or as the defense minister. Old antagonisms, a little bit of personality clash, yeah. So, on March 10th, with Dayan and Peres back in the regime, Golda is able to put forth a cabinet with a very slim majority of 61 seats. She was able to cobble it together, and the NRP came back into the fold. The NRP was not willing to join the government unless Dayan and Peres were involved. Now, the reason is because Dayan and Peres were hawks, And the NRP doesn't want to have a very dovish government. It's going to give away the store, give away the territories. Because after all, the NRP now represents not just Shomer Shabbos Jews, but right-wing settler Jews. So you have a 68-member coalition that seems reasonably stable, with all the heavy hitters back in their old positions, and now with Shimon Peres as the information minister, and a very disgruntled Yitzhak Rabin as the labor minister. He was thrown some crumbs of the labor ministry. Here he thought he was going to be the defense minister, the Gansamacher, you know? And all of a sudden, Dayan comes right rushing back in, pushes Rabin to the side, they throw him a little ministry, a nothing ministry, the labor ministry.
What was Rabin's role during...
Nothing. He was a private citizen, so they gave him a job to try to raise money for the war fund. But he was basically a private citizen, which was to his advantage because nobody could blame him for what went wrong. Okay, so during the course of the early months of 1974, the Agranat Commission was receiving testimony. Now, the Agranat Commission was established by the State of Israel to investigate what happened and why there were failures in the early phases of the Yom Kippur War. It was led by Shimon Agranat, the head of the Supreme Court, and it had five members, two of whom were former chiefs of staff, Laskov and Yigal Yadin. They took testimony from this person, that person, all the relevant parties. 58 different people testified. And everyone is waiting for their interim report, which will be released in April of 74. Their final report will be released in July of 75, and it was 1,500 pages, of which only 46 were made available to the public. The rest was kept censored. 30 years after that, all 1,500 pages, except for 40 pages, were made public. The other 40 pages will remain sealed forever until Yemos HaMashiach. Okay, so this report, everyone's waiting. Well, who's it going to blame? Who's at fault? And the conclusion, well, before I tell you the conclusion, I'll give you just one line, unless I mentioned it last week. When Golda was being interviewed by Yadin, he asked a question. Was the delayed mobilization on the eve of Yom Kippur something that you thought was in the best interests of the country? Or did you delay mobilization out of concern that a preemptive and unnecessary mobilization will make the Labour Party look bad at the polls? In other words, was it politically motivated as opposed to you were doing your job in the real way? And Golda's response was, I'm sorry, I don't know enough Hebrew in order to answer that in the most diplomatic of fashion. So basically, she wanted to use English, which she spoke better than Hebrew, to say a few choice words to Yigal Yadin for even asking the chutzpah to ask that question.
But didn't you say 2 weeks ago that they delayed one of the reasons because they wouldn't get any material from the United States?
So that was a preemptive strike, which would have caused a problem with the United States. The delayed mobilization was because of a fear of Dayan's that it would be regarded as a cause for war, that the other side would attack first and have legitimate cause for war regarding a full-fledged Israeli mobilization as akin to an attack. Okay, and there were other factors as well. Well, another factor was that some elements within the military were saying it wasn't necessary within the viewpoint of Eli Zaira that there wasn't going to be a war. Remember, not until the day of the war were the intelligence officials convinced that it really was going to happen. Okay, so everyone's waiting for this report to be released. On April 1st, it's released. And it calls for the dismissal of six military officers, including David Elazar, the chief of staff, Eli Zira, the head of Amman, and four other figures, his deputy Shalev, and three other figures who were associated with the Southern Command or intelligence officers with responsibility for Egypt. So the six officers are going to be dismissed, and their fate is whatever it is. Each one goes their own way. Some of them don't have very glorious futures. No, Sharon was seen as a heroic figure. Yeah. I mean, except insofar as he violated orders and got his reserve commission revoked because he was bad-mouthing the top leadership. But who was held to be not responsible, at least for the security matters? Dayan and Golda Meir. That the cabinet officials had fulfilled their duties. The report did not say there shall be no political repercussions. That's for the electorate, the voters, to decide. But that from a standpoint of security, the government ministers functioned appropriately. It's just that things didn't go all that well. In other words, there's no responsibility for the defense minister or the prime minister to be like a super-level chief of staff of the army. The chief of staff of the army is the highest officer of the army and is responsible for giving good information to the political establishment. And if they fail, so they fail, but it's the army's fault. Now, this...
Did Elazar fail in that?
So Elazar was very bitter over this report because, and he had right to be bitter, it only focused on the early days of the war and the part of the war that didn't go very well. It completely ignored the second and third weeks of the war when everything seemed to go right and Israel went on a counteroffensive and even conquered territory.
Under the same leadership.
Now, David Elazar was credited by all of his colleagues and by the political class for being the steady hand that didn't freak out, but rather kept a level head, a cool head, all throughout the hostilities and was able to function and get to victory. But that's not what the Agronaut report was focused on. It was only concerned with the Mechdal, the failure of the beginning. And for that, David Elazar had to fall on his sword and go away. Sadly,
he died.
It broke his heart. He had a heart attack at the age of 49, 50, and died 2 years later. The mandate was specific to security matters and the first phase of the war. It was not to determine political considerations or even the latter phases of the war. Okay, so...
Did Elazar favor mobilization?
Yes, Elazar did. He wanted 200,000 men, and he ordered the Air Force to be mobilized even without permission. So he was gung-ho about it. Yes.
So why was he shafted?
It's a fair question. Now, some say, Yesh Omrim, that the two former chiefs of staff, Laskov and Yadin, were biased in favor of Moshe Dayan, their buddy, as a former chief of staff. And so they gave him, the sitting defense minister, a pass out of personal favoritism.
They were contemporaries. That's
true. So
Elazar
was a decade younger than them. So there's a reason to make that claim, but everyone involved denies it.
Didn't Jordan speak to Golda now?
Yes, on September 25th, he flew to Tel Aviv and told her war was imminent, and it was dismissed, or dismissed by some and accepted by others. Okay, so... Yes, there was plenty of evidence. I mean, it was staring them in the face that there were major buildups in the south and in the north, but they chose to ignore it and to interpret it in other ways. All right, let's keep going. So the public was angry over this whitewashing of the mistakes of the political class. They wanted the heads to roll, not in the IDF, but in the cabinet. Even within the political class, there were those who said, this report is ridiculous. Yitzhak Rabin, Abba Eben, Yigal Alon, Pinchas Sapir all saw that there's something wrong here. It's not sitting right that the two top leaders should get a free pass. So on April 3rd, Dayan offers to resign. And unlike the previous two times when he offered to resign and Golda refused, this time she didn't refuse. She said, okay, I understand why you want to walk away, but let's put it to the Labour Party leadership. In other words, I'm not going to make the decision, and even you're not going to make the decision. We're going to go to the party, and the party's going to figure out who are the ministerial candidates for the upcoming cabinet, or for the current cabinet, because it's already been established, going forward. But then, as the tumult increased, and there was more and more blame shifted towards Golda herself, she said, all right, that's it, I'm out of here, I resign, April 10th. It's irrevocable that on several other occasions she had resigned various positions, whether it was foreign minister, the head of the Mapai, the head of the Labour Party, or even prime ministership itself, and she always walked back that resignation in return for some reconsideration of the political circumstance. Here she said, no, don't try to get me to go back into the job, I am finished, it's done. It's done.
How old was she at that time?
She was 76.
How was her health?
Her health, all throughout her term of 5 years as prime minister, she had bad health. But yet, she was a very vigorous person. She led a tough schedule. So somehow, while she needed the koyach to run the country, she had the koyach to run the country. After it was over, it was all downhill. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time.
Filters or not?
No, no filter. No filter. Okay. She refused to smoke filtered. All right. So now the question is, who will be the next prime minister? Or rather, who's going to be the next prime minister tomorrow or the day after? Golda had favored new elections and a caretaker government until the election. Because the halacha is that if you call new elections, the sitting cabinet remains in place as a caretaker administration until such time as a new administration can be formed on the basis of the results of the next election cycle, which would have given her some few months to continue functioning, as much as a half a year maybe. But the Labor Party overrode her preference and said, no, that's not going to happen. There will not be a caretaker government and there will not be new elections. There will rather be a prime ministerial candidate's race within the Labour Party Central Committee, and whoever wins that will be the prime minister, assuming they can cobble together a cabinet on the basis of the existing Knesset. Okay. Why did the Labour Party Central Committee prefer that route? Because they didn't want to lose, and the thinking was that they would lose badly. So you keep the whatever margin of victory you've already had from a few months earlier, and you put some other guy at the top. But who's that guy going to be? That's the big question. So the most logical candidate was Pinchas Sapir, the longtime finance minister. He was in his late 60s at that point. But he was from roughly that generation, the founding guard of Mapainix, and he was the party kingmaker. But he said, it's not for me. I don't want to be the prime minister. He had a few reasons. Number one, he says, I'm already too old, which was a bluff because he wasn't that old. Secondly, I don't know matters of war and peace and defense. I'm a finance guy. I just know domestic and money issues. And we need somebody at time of war to protect us. It's not me. Also, he said, as the finance minister, I've been responsible for several very unpopular measures that had to be taken to rescue the economy in moments of great difficulty. And so therefore, people have reason not to like me. And you don't want someone coming into the job who's already despised. And lastly, he said, I simply don't want the stress. If it was a choice of jumping out of a 10th floor window or taking the prime minister's job, I'd jump out of the 10th floor window. So instead, what did he do? He was not invited into the next cabinet as the finance minister. Actually, what he did was he became the head of the Jewish agency, which at that time was in charge, you know, mostly of Aliyah, immigration, and then he died shortly thereafter. Actually, he died fairly young, and I think a year later he was gone. So he can have a choice who he wants to be the next prime minister, but it isn't going to be him. Who is his choice? Well, who are the options? What are the options out there? Give me some names.
Paris.
Who else? Rabin. Who else?
No, Rabin.
Who else?
Menachem Begin.
Well, no. I mean, within the Labor Party. Yigal Alon. Abba Ibn. Or a wild card. Who knows what? So, let's see who has a chance and who doesn't have a chance. Sapir was of the view that whoever would be chosen should be at least have the tacit support, although not open support, of Golda Meir. In other words, there should be some continuity here. It shouldn't be that Golda's arch enemy takes over for her. That's one point in Sapir's view. The other is, it should be someone with a loyalty to the party and not a dissident faction within the party, which means that Sapir doesn't want Peres, because Peres is just a another name. Is like Dayan equals Rafi equals dissident element, and we can't trust them. So you want either a Mapai person, or worse comes to worse, an Achdut Avodah person, because Achdut Avodah and Mapai had made enough shalom that they were no longer regarded as a dissident faction. So Sapir doesn't want Peres. Abba Ibn considered running. Sapir went over to him and said, listen, Abba, nobody's going to vote for you. You're going to get 90 votes out of 600 in the Central Committee. You're going to embarrass yourself. So do yourself a favor. Pick someone you like and support them, and your base of support will follow that candidate. That might put them over the edge to get a 50% majority. Because Abba Ibn was a British Jew. He was an American. He wasn't an Israeli. He was he was born in South Africa. He grew up in England. He spent a decade in America. He was everywhere but Israel. And although everyone appreciated his oratorical skills, no one really was devoted to his vision of politics. And also, he was very dovish. At a time when, although there is a dovish wing of the Labour Party, the majority was still either centrist or to the right. So he's not...
In the military?
Huh? So Abba Ibn was an intelligence officer in the British Army, served 5 years in the British Army, and then became a Zionist operative. 1945, he was released from the army, became a British operative, a Zionist operative. So Ibn is out. Who's Ibn going to throw his support behind? Well, ironically, it'll be Peres, not Rabin. Why? Because Ibn and Rabin didn't get along. I would say that they hated each other. Why did they hate each other? Well, while Ibn was foreign minister, Ibn wasn't really foreign minister. He was foreign minister for cocktail parties. But Rabin was the one who was going to the White House and going to the important figures in the American administration and making all the wheeling and dealing.
Because he was ambassador.
He wasn't just ambassador. He was the most trusted and most elevated of all the ambassadors. Just like when Golda was foreign minister, really she was the foreign minister for cocktails and horror dancing. And who was really getting the job done? Shimon Peres was signing all the deals with all the foreign countries. So there was ill will there. There was ill will. So even though Peres was a hawk, if you can believe that, Peres was a hawk, and Ibn was a dove, Ibn supported Peres over Rabin because of personal broigus. Okay. Now what about Yigal Alon? So Yigal Alon didn't really stand a chance because Sapir told him, your time has come and gone. Your chance was 5 years ago when it was you versus Dayan, and the end result was a pshara, a compromise of neither of you when Golda became prime minister. And you don't stand a chance here, so pick one to support and not the other, and you'll help influence who the winner will be. So Sapir was brilliant. He told most of the candidates, you can't win, so you just support somebody and they'll go to the victory. But really, what were the knocks against Alon? So first of all, some people didn't like the fact that after the 48 war, he left the army. Now, he wasn't dismissed from the army, but the Palmach was disbanded by Ben-Gurion, and all the Mapamniks, who Ben-Gurion didn't trust because they were too far to the left, kind of had their military careers cut short. So what did Alon do? He went to England to study for a little bit. He went to the United States to study for a little bit. He was out of the country for a while. Then he comes back. He's an Achdut Avodah person, which is a dissident faction. So there are a few knocks against him. Also, he was regarded as a little bit of a loser. Not in the sense of like Shimon Peres would later be seen as a loser because he actually lost a lot of elections, but rather that Alon didn't have what it took to get to the top. He would always be a rung or two, below the top. You're right, he didn't. But he was not a bad speaker. Actually, I mean, he's before my time, but I like Yigal Alon as a historical personality. He's a short guy, yeah. That's true, it's true. Okay, so...
Did Golda have much of a say at this point?
So Golda reluctantly favored Rabin because she hated Peres. She thought Peres was an evil man, dating back to the 50s when they would fight over who would be responsible for foreign affairs. Okay, so what happens next? Rabin is told, you should run for office. He's a little bit surprised because it's only 3 weeks earlier that he began his ministerial career as Minister of Labor, and only 3 months earlier that he began his career as a Knesset member. I mean, he was brand new. He's a neophyte to politics. He doesn't know all that much about how the country runs. So he's supposed to be the prime minister. He's a little bit surprised at turning to him, and he's nervous. Can I even do this? So what were the strong arguments in favor of his candidacy, and what were the arguments against his candidacy? So in favor of his candidacy were a few things. One, he was a successful and regarded as a victorious and heroic chief of staff of the army. So that's number one. There aren't that many chiefs of staffs out there, and not that many who had a great career and won a big war. Secondly, he's a Sabra. Okay, there had not been yet a prime minister born in Eretz Yisrael. Everyone had been a foreigner. Also, he was regarded as honest. Now, in the realm of politics, this is a rarity. Okay, so he was regarded as honest in that when you spoke to him, you didn't get the sense that there was a multi-layered truth behind what he was actually saying, that he was really telling you the full measure of what he thought. The Americans believed that, and the Israeli public instinctively understood that. By contrast, Shimon Peres, everything you said that he said, you had to interpret with the five perushim. What did he really mean? Because there was something behind it that he wasn't really telling you. So he's a sabra. He's honest. He was a chief of staff. He was a successful ambassador to the United States at a time when relations with the United States are going to prove to be critical, and maybe he is the right man for the job. So these are all nice points in his favor. What are the points against him?
It was a good point that he wasn't touched by anything.
Okay, good. The most important thing was he was not involved with the Yom Kippur War. You can't blame him for the failure. So he's clean. He's a leading figure within the alignment, within the Labor Party, who doesn't have this stain on his record, when everybody else almost has this stain on the record. He was just a private citizen. He was not in the army. He was out of his ambassador job. He was waiting to run for Knesset on the alignment list at spot number, I think, 20, which was a guaranteed spot. So he knew he was going to be a Knesset member, but he was not one yet. He was just a private citizen.
Did you recruit him or anything?
For what?
For the war?
No. Others who were already out of the army were recruited. So, for example, Chaim Bar-Lev was a former chief of staff, went to become Southern Commander, and Ariel Sharon was retired but became a division commander, but Rabin was not. Okay, so...
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know.
He was an ambassador to the UN.
Yeah, to the United States.
Was back to him, say, at that time. And maybe they didn't want to put a diplomat into...
I don't know. I think it was never suggested. That's what the impression that I get from what I've read. So, what were the knocks against Rabin? Number one, he doesn't speak well in public. He's not a good orator. Number two, no sense of humor. Dry. Number three, he doesn't seem to connect well with people, putting aside the oratorical skills, just in terms of interpersonal relations. They accused him of being autistic, which was not a nice thing to say about him, but he didn't have a good warm relations with others. So that may be more important than anything else, but I'm giving you the various things that were used to criticize his candidacy. Also, the nervous breakdown will come up big time. Another thing that was held against him, he was Achdut Avodah, not Mapai. He was introverted. He was distant. He was new to politics. And he was not interested in anything other than foreign affairs and defense. Now, you could argue, well, that's exactly what we need right now. But the prime minister does have a responsibility to govern the country on domestic issues as well. And if he has no concern for matters of the economy or for labor or religion and state, which he had no interest in, then do you really want him the head of the cabinet? Maybe defense minister, but to be the prime minister? Okay, so these were some knocks against him. Also, he took money for speeches. In other words, he was not a Spartan individual who was going to live like in a one-bedroom apartment and have no kesef. Huh?
He wasn't
Menachem Begin. He wasn't David Ben-Gurion. He wanted to live... He played tennis, which tells you everything. He like Eben played golf, you know. It means you like to enjoy life a little bit beyond the simple... frugal existence of the old Mapai guard. Bibi's in a class by himself. Him and Abu Mazen. Lahavdil. So, the last argument against him was, well, he had a breakdown. Now, people knew that in 1967, Rabin had a bad episode between May 23rd, late in the day, and the morning of May 25th. The official record was that he had a health episode. Some said it was nicotine poisoning, that he was living on cigarettes and not food for a week. And maybe that's true. But the idea that it was a mental breakdown means that he can't function under pressure. So, who leaked this to the media? No. You would think so, but it actually was to Peres' advantage, but it wasn't Peres. It was Azer Weitzman. What does Azer have to do with it? The answer is, Azer wanted to be Rabin's successor as chief of staff. He was a deputy. And Rabin did not recommend him for the job. And so when that happened, then Azer never became chief of staff, which, bear in mind, until later in Israel's history, no head of the Air Force ever became chief of staff. It wasn't until much later that happened. Dan Chalutz, it didn't work well. So Azer held a grudge, and he said, one day, I'm going to get you back. And so he released it to Haaretz about this breakdown. So Rabin, on the eve of the election, April 22nd, Labor Party Central Committee had to defend himself somehow. So what did he do? He decided, you know what, I'll get three generals who were my underlings during the war to write letters of recommendation on my behalf. So he got Yisrael Tal and Aaron Yariv, and the third one he wanted to get was Ariel Sharon. If Sharon will say that I know what I'm doing and I'm you can have confidence in me, then I'll win the election. Because after all, Arik Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, 1974, Ariel Sharon is considered the Lion of Israel, the Hero of Israel. So he calls, they can't find him. Rabin's underling calls Uri Dan. Remember Uri Dan? He wrote for the New York Post. He was a journalist. So Uri Dan's claim to fame was that he was Ariel Sharon's best friend, personal best friend. So they find Uri Dan. They say, Uri, you got to find Ariel for us and get him to write this letter. So Sharon was having breakfast at the Tel Aviv Hilton. Uri Dan finds him. They sit down for breakfast. And Uri Dan says, this is what Rabin wants. So, are you willing to write the letter? And so Sharon says to Dan, is he going to reciprocate the favor at some point? Am I going to get anything out of this? Or is it going to be business as usual with him? And Uri Dan says, well, it'll probably be business as usual. He'll shaft you and give you nothing. To which Ariel thought for a second, you know what? I'll write the letter because he'll be better than Peres anyway. So even though I get nothing out of it, better him than Peres. So he wrote a two-sentence thing on a napkin that they faxed to the office, and quickly it was in the newspapers that Ariel Sharon said that Yitzhak Rabin was a great general who led us to victory.
Is Mata Gur
still around? He was the chief of staff. No, because he wanted someone who served underneath him at the general level. Mata Gur was not a general at that time. He was, I think, a colonel. I don't know. So, very good. Although there were partisan differences, we're going to see next week. We're not going to get to it tonight, but next week we'll discuss the problems of Rabin's term as prime minister, and Sharon served as his military advisor. Why? I'll explain in a few minutes. That I'll explain.
Wait a minute. You talked about that breakdown.
Yeah.
So what was it, 48 hours?
36 hours.
Quick mental breakdown, in other words.
Yeah.
Refuah Shleimah.
There was a good Mishaberach from Rav Gorin,
His term, if somebody is very depressed and can't move, and really.
Listen, Joseph Stalin couldn't get out of bed for 10 days after Operation Barbarossa began and the Nazis invaded Soviet Union. That's a real mental breakdown. Who knows? Maybe it was just nicotine poisoning.
Maybe.
So, April 22nd, they go to the polls. And the final score is 298 for Rabin, 254 for Shimon Peres. Yitzhak Rabin, the newbie to politics, is set to be the prime minister. Peres, of course, is not happy. But what's going to happen now? Well, a lot of horse trading is going to happen now, because all we know is that Rabin is the guy at the top. Who holds all the other positions? And everybody has an ego, a big ego, and there's a lot of breakers going around between people who don't like each other. So what happens next? Well, first of all, Golda is still prime minister until June 3rd, until the new cabinet can form itself. And in the meantime, the separation of forces agreement with Syria is signed, and the Maalot massacre happens. So Golda was in the top position as those things were unfolding. The cabinet is in formation, and the big question is, who is going to be the defense minister? So Yitzhak Rabin, the former chief of staff, now set to be prime minister in a country where historically the prime minister often also held a defense portfolio. Well, who's the likeliest candidate for defense minister? Yitzhak Rabin himself. Himself. But he questions whether or not that's a good idea. What's the question? He's new to governing. He was a soldier, and now he's new to politics. It's a tough job being prime minister of Israel. It's a tough job being defense minister of Israel. Can he really take on both jobs simultaneously when he has no experience? Maybe it's, you know, tafasta maruba lo tafasta. You know, he grabbed too much, he can't grab anything. So that's one reason. But there's another problem. And that is, what do I do with Shimon Peres? He can't just ignore the fact that Peres won almost half the vote and that a significant chunk of the Labour Party wanted Peres at the top. He's going to have to give Peres a significant cabinet portfolio. Otherwise, Rafi will bolt from the coalition and there'll be no coalition. And there'll be a new election and Menachem Begin could be prime minister, for all we know. So he has to give him the defense ministry. And Shimon wants the defense ministry. After all, that was his life. His whole career, from 1947 to 1965, Shimon Peres was the man of the defense ministry, as the chief buyer in New York, then as the director general, as the CEO of the defense ministry, then as the deputy defense minister from 59 to 65. Shimon Peres was Mr. Defense, Mr. Security, not as a soldier, but as a civilian. And he was lusting for the defense portfolio to be the minister. Yeah. Oh, big time, yeah, sure, he was Mr. Oslo. So why the shift? All right, so I was going to save this maybe for next week, but I'll give you the 30-second version. He was a hawk out of personal inclination and because he was a protege of Ben-Gurion, who was a hawk and an activist militarily, and he was the colleague, although the younger and underling colleague, of Moshe Dayan, who also held hawkish positions on the territories and was a military, was an activist when it comes to matters of defense. So as long as Ben-Gurion was alive and as long as Dayan was on the scene and in a more senior position to Peres, he really wasn't in a position to assert himself and assert any more dovish views, if he even wanted to. By the late 70s, Ben-Gurion was dead and Dayan was no longer relevant, or he was foreign minister under Begin, but then he died himself in 81, out of the picture. And Peres believed in peace through strength, and strength had been achieved through a nuclear deterrent and through at least a peace agreement with Egypt. So by the 1980s, Peres was a big-time dove who believed in not Palestinian statehood necessarily, but the need to relinquish the bulk of the West Bank and Gaza in return for some arrangement with the Arabs, whether the Jordanians or local Palestinians, although he preferred the Jordanians. So it's sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, that Shimon Peres turns into a big-time dove after having been regarded as a super hawk. It was not I would say this is not an example of a politician who changes their stripes because it's politically expedient. So there's a certain senator from upstate New York who does that. That wasn't Peres. He sincerely had a transformation. Okay, so
he could afford to be. From your saying, what the situation?
The situation evolved. It evolved. Yes, Israel in 1979 or 1982, or certainly 84 when he becomes prime minister, is not Israel of 1965 or Israel of 1972 or 73.
You can afford to be dovish.
Yes, yes. Change of circumstances. Of the Middle East. Yes, yes, yes. Oh, yeah, so next week it's going to be the main focus of our attention. That will be a big problem for Rabin. Rabin's first term as prime minister is basically a failure. One of the big reasons is the Gush Emunim movement. Okay, so he has to give the defense ministry to Peres. He doesn't really want to for a few reasons. One, personal animosity. Two, the thinking that Peres was still Dayan's lackey, and Dayan will not take orders from Rabin, even if Rabin is prime minister, so therefore you create like a logjam where nothing can get done. And three, Peres was too hawkish and would not advance the peace process, and Rabin had every intention of advancing the peace process in the mid-70s. So he flirted with bring the National Religious Party into the coalition in the hopes that having the National Religious Party would enable him to have a cushion just in case Rafi or a few members of Rafi ran to the opposition. But that didn't work out, at least not early on. Okay, so Peres got the job. Now, yes, was headed by Berg. They were becoming more and more hawkish, yes. He himself was not, but he gave in to the wishes of Hanan Porat and the others. So now you have a problem. Alon had been deputy prime minister, had been minister of education, had wanted to be defense minister all these years, had wanted to be prime minister all these years, but got neither of those two jobs. And now he's going to be really disappointed. You got to give him something big, or else he's going to run away with the Achdut Avodah crowd. So Rabin goes over to him and says, listen, pal, I can't make you defense minister for reasons that I can explain and are perfectly rational. So what can I give you as a compensation? You want the foreign ministry? And Alon says, no, not good enough. So they think about it for 3 hours, and Rabin says, okay, I'll give you the foreign ministry and you'll retain your title as deputy prime minister. Is that good enough? And Alon said, fine. So he took it, grudgingly. Now there's a problem. What happened to Abba Eben? He's out of a job.
Yeah.
So Eben found out on the radio that he was out of a job. This is before there was Donald Trump on Twitter firing a chief of staff or a cabinet member. There was Yitzhak Rabin firing Abba Eben over the radio. Okay, so now Eben, of course, was very offended. He didn't like Rabin to begin with. But many people in the Labor Party were now up in arms. How can you do this to the good old Abba? You know, he's been our main spokesman for a quarter century. He's from the Chutz La'aretz point of view, from the standpoint of the Goyim, who is Israel? Abba Eben, the voice of Israel. How could you do this to him? And Rabin's simple answer was, well, 8 years is long enough. Everybody has their time. Goodbye. So Rabin denied that it was for personal reasons. He said it was enough time. Everybody has their moment in the sun. We need a little revolving door.
Is he ever U.S. Ambassador to the U.S.?
Yes, for 9 years. He was simultaneously U.N. and U.S. 50 to 59. Okay, so with Eben out, what is he going to do? So he goes off to America. Well, first he goes to Cambridge and teaches for a semester. Then he goes to New York and teaches at NYU for a semester. He was at Columbia for a while. And he wrote a few books, and he made a lot of money off those books. Then he did some television, the movies, The Nation is Born. He did a lot of things, but he didn't resign his Knesset seat. He kept in the Knesset officially and returned to Israel about a year later and sat in the Knesset plenum, give dirty looks, like dagger eyes to Rabin the whole time, being a real enemy of his. Okay, so this was the cabinet. You had Rabin, the prime minister, Peres, the defense minister, and Alon, the foreign minister and deputy PM. The rest of the cabinet, figures we don't have to worry about now.
What did the deputy
Sapir PM was out, he was head of the Jewish agency.
What did the deputy PM do, unless there was an assassination?
When the prime minister goes out of the country, he's in charge for a few weeks. Or, you know, when you have an inner cabinet, the inner circle, the deputy PM plays an important role, has a voice almost at the level of the prime minister, which would happen periodically when there's a crisis. Yeah.
What happened to the leadership of the military? Because they wanted Elazar to...
So Elazar was out and Matagur was in.
Well, that happened at the same time?
It happened right away in April of 74. In April of 74. Immediately. So, now, what happens next? So, the cabinet exists, but there's a shadow cabinet. Like in England, you have the shadow cabinet, you know, from the opposition. But this time, the shadow cabinet was not the opposition of the Likud. It was the old guard that wasn't dead yet, but was just annoyed that they were out of power. So instead of you have Rabin and Peres and Alon here, you have in the shadow cabinet Golda, Moshe Dayan, Pinchas Sapir, and Abba Eben. All the folks who used to hold the important jobs and now don't. Okay. Well, why did Rabin dislike Peres so much, aside from the fact that in general a lot of people didn't like Peres? There were a few reasons. One of them had to do with the fact that back in 1964, Shimon Peres had opposed when David Ben-Gurion elevated Rabin to the position of chief of staff. And then once he did, they clashed, as the deputy defense minister and the chief of staff sometimes do. So this was an old feud that was now going to intensify. It's known in the biography of Rabin as the long duel. The long duel, because it would have several rounds. This was just one of several rounds that would end only with his death in 1995. Peres disliked Rabin, but Rabin hated Peres. The intensity of the ill will was 1,000 times greater Rabin towards Peres than it was Peres towards Rabin. Just to keep that in mind. One of the reasons that Rabin rejected Peres' candidacy for the top job was he felt, how could it be that the State of Israel and the Labor Party would elect a man to the top position who never wore a uniform? That everyone else had worn the uniform. Now, is that true?
No, Ben-Gurion never.
Okay, so Ben-Gurion wore the uniform of the Jewish Legion. Moshe Sharet wore the uniform of the Turkish army. Levi Eshkol wore the uniform of the Jewish Legion. Golda Meir protested that women were excluded from the Jewish Legion. Okay, so his idea was, how could you have someone who didn't put their life in danger, in harm's way? Yeah, you're right. It's too bourgeois. Okay, so at this point, no more electioneering or politicking. Question is, what will Rabin's tenure be like? And sadly, Israel reached a point that America would reach a few years later. When you think of the presidency of Jimmy Carter, what word comes to mind? Malaise, bingo. And the other word? Stagflation. Stagflation. Okay, but malaise was the word I was looking for. Israel had the same problem, but just a few years earlier, under Rabin. Well, the economy was bad. Inflation was at 50% when he went into office. Unemployment was high. They had lost a lot of money as a result of the war. The balance of payments was out of whack. And many people had died, and many people were injured. So there was a sense that the better years of Israel were behind it. And a song was playing on the radio, written by Yehonatan Geffen and played by Arik Einstein. And the name of the song was Yachol Liyot Shezeh Nigmar. What does that mean? It could be that it's all over. So let me read to you the Hebrew. And I normally don't quote poems here, but because it has an important political overtone. Omrim Shehaya Po Sameach Lifnei Shnoladati. They say that, you know, it was a happy times before I was born. V'Yachol Ya Pashut Nifla Ad Shehigati. And all was wonderful before I showed up on the scene. Shomer Ivri al Sus Lavan, a Hebrew guardman on a white horse. Now, what is that supposed to evoke memories of? No. It's supposed to bring back memories of Bar Giora, Hashomer, and the Haganah. But even before the Haganah, the Hashomer, where you had guys riding on a white horse up in the Galilee, shooting, you know, revolvers at stray Arabs who were trying to steal from the plantation. Okay,
they were dressed like Arabs.
Yeah. Okay. Balaila Shachor Al Safata Kineret Trumpodor Hayagibor. And the dark night, the Laila Shachor is supposed to remind you of what it's like before the whole country is built up. Like, you look in the sky in Woodmere, you don't see the stars. You go out to Iowa to the farm, you look up, you see the stars. By Israel of the 70s, already there was enough pollution and urban sprawl that, you know, you looked up, you didn't always see the stars. But in 1905, 1910, when things were beginning, you looked up at Shemayim, you saw God. Okay, you actually saw the heavens. And Trumpeldor, Hayagibor, 1920, the Battle of Tel Chai, Joseph Trumpeldor dying a martyr's death. It's good to die for one's country, so he said. And then, Tel Aviv Haktana. Little Tel Aviv. Okay, 1909, a bunch of sand dunes at the outskirts of Jaffa. They built up Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv was a little city in the teens, the 20s, the 30s. A nice, cute little city. Bialik Echad, Shnei Etzim Shikmim. So there was one Bialik, there were two eucalyptus trees. There wasn't much here, but whatever we had was good. And Bialik, a cultural icon. Anashim Yafim Melaim Chalomot. Beautiful people, full of dreams. And we all came to the land to build and to be built ourselves. The idea being, we're going to build up the physical infrastructure, but also the diaspora Jew, the weak diaspora Jew, has to toughen himself up, to build himself up, to become a new Jew. Kilanu lanu aretz zot, because this land is our land. Kan efo shataru et adeshe hayapam raki tushimu beitzot. Here, where you see grass, where you see cultivation, before we drained the swamps from malaria, what did you have? The yitushim, you had the bugs, the malaria, the flies. Amru shepam hayakan chalom nehadar. They say there was once here a wonderful, glorious dream. Aval keshebati lirot lo matzati shum davar. But when I came to take a look, I didn't find anything. Yachol liot sheze nigmar. Could be that it's all over. Then it goes on. Omrim sheyapo semech lifnei nolati. They say it was great before I got here. Pamach, there's the pamach, cafe shachor, black coffee, kochavim anglim, British stars. What does that mean? The Union Jack, okay, the flag of the British mandate. Machteret, the underground, the Haganah, the Lehi, the Irgun. V'yalkut ha-kesavim. What's the yalkut ha-kesavim? The pack of lies, meaning the extent to which the British reneged on the Balfour Declaration by having the white paper, the Chiltern white paper. In other words, they always were sticking it to the Jews.
It's a song of the history.
Exactly. Kafia al-Tsavar, a kafia on the neck. Now, what's that referring to? It could be referring to the Shomer, where the Jews actually wore the kafia. Or it could be referring to even when the Arabs wore it in the old days, a more primitive time. Not the 70s, when by then even the Arabs were wearing skinny jeans. Okay, Yaron Zahavi, Alterman, Tamar. So they're quoting references to names like Nathan Alterman, a great poet. Bachurot Yafot, pretty girls, Mechnasayim Ktzarim, in short shorts. Okay, Vahayala Embish. All right, but they said it was better in the old days. So Vahayalahem Bishvil Malakum Baboker. This is the most important line of the poem. Hayalahem Bishvil Malakum Baboker. They had a reason to get up in the morning. Kilano Arts Azot, because it was our country. But Yachol Yosh is enigmar. Maybe it's all over. The idea being, by the 1970s, the malaise had kicked in. We don't even have a reason to get up in the morning. After you almost lose a war, people are injured, they're sad, and the whole thing is defunct. The drive, the zeal, for the Zionist passion for building a country has waned. And maybe it's a lost cause. So the last one out at Ben-Gurion, turn off the light, is the joke. So this is all exaggerated. I mean, yes, there's malaise, but there's also a country of 3 million Jews who want to live the next day and thrive. So there's a way out of the malaise. You have to just wake yourself up from the doldrums. So with all this in mind, what is Rabin facing in his term of office? What does he want to accomplish? And what's reasonable for him to accomplish? Because he could have all sorts of dreams and goals. It doesn't mean they could realistically come to pass. So he does believe that there can be progress on the peace front. And in fact, the Geneva Conference of December of 1973 was seen as something that worked in labor's favor. That when Eben went to Geneva and gave a good speech and sat at the same table as some of the Arab delegates, although not the Syrians, they refused to sit near a Jew, to Kito Evahi Lasuria, like out of the Bible. So that supposedly was enabling Labor to pick up 4 or 5 seats in the election. The polling data indicated that they were going to do worse than they actually did. And people credit Eban for getting us an extra few seats, okay? But now he's out. So the people want peace negotiations. They want to know there isn't going to be another Yom Kippur War. As for territorial compromise, all right, well, there are differences of opinion, some being less inclined to territorial compromise and some being more willing. But people want peace. And Rabin understands this, and he thinks that within a limited time frame, there's going to be some progress. But, and here's the kicker, and it's where it's going to get himself into trouble, he doesn't think that peace can happen until the IDF rebuilds its strength after having taken a pounding in the Yom Kippur War. And it's going to take a few years for the IDF to recover to the fullest extent. It's going to require time for building up the manpower. That's one thing. The kids have to turn 18 and get inducted. And you need the material. which means you need American cooperation because they're the main supplier of arms and free money. So it's an odd situation where to the Americans, Rabin has to show that he is dovish, because the Americans want to know that there's going to be some progress towards peace, or else they're not going to cooperate with military support. But to the Israelis, he has to show that he's hawkish, because they're not yet ready for territorial compromise. And he did not come into office by electoral means. He was just thrust into office, so he doesn't really have a mandate. And even if he had one, it wasn't to give away the store. So there's this delicate balance that he has to try to strike of showing the Americans that we've been weakened, so we need your arms, but we're willing to talk and negotiate peace, so you should be willing to give us arms. But to the Israelis, say, we're going to stand firm and have secure borders.
Wouldn't there be a parity between the United States and Russia for rearming Egypt?
Not exactly. The Russians are not walking away from the region, because they remain very tight with Syria. But the Egyptians and the Soviets have something of a parting of the ways. Under Sadat, the Egyptians understood that the solution to their problems was American help, American financing, and the way to get it was through a peace agreement with Israel. The problem is that Sadat wasn't yet ready for a separate peace with Israel outside the context of a broader Arab-Israeli rapprochement. The whole goal of Geneva was that all the Arabs together would make some sort of arrangement with Israel. That failed. And ultimately, you know the rest of the story, that Egypt does make a separate peace in 1978-79. But in 1974, they were not ready for that yet. Or at least nobody could have foreseen that that was going to be the course of events. Okay, so in the last 2 minutes we have left, so Rabin wants to have peace, and he knows that it's essential for sustaining decent relations with the Americans, but he doesn't have a mandate. So he promised the Israeli voter that if there will be a territorial withdrawal from the Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to the Sinai, which doesn't count, but if there's going to be a territorial withdrawal from Eretz Yisrael, it will be put to a referendum. A referendum. Now, lav dafka, a referendum, like a real separate referendum, but it could be meaning new Knesset elections, which is the functional equivalent of a referendum. I mean, in Israeli history, there haven't been too many referendums. As far as I could tell, only the direct election of prime minister, the handful of times that they did it. Otherwise, every election has been a Knesset election. But that's what he promised. Also, he wants the NRP into his government. He doesn't have them at first. He has Shula Amir Aloni, causes trouble for everyone wherever she goes. She just is a tough cookie to deal with. But she only has 3 seats. So it's too narrow a coalition. It's a 61-seat coalition. It's a razor-thin majority. He wants National Religious Party, but he knows that they're hawkish. And he can't give away anything with them involved, certainly not in Gaza and the West Bank, or maybe the Golan. The Sinai, even the National Religious Party is willing to give in, because it's not historic Eretz Yisrael. In other words, the oil fields of the Sinai are not Hebron and Har HaBayit. There's a big difference between one and the other. So that's a concern. And also economically, he has to get the country back into decent economic shape to reduce inflation, to reduce unemployment. And to accomplish that, he's going to need foreign assistance, notably, again, the Americans, but also curtailing the standard of living in Israel such that things are improved. Well, he has very little success on the diplomatic front, because the only ones who are interested in making a separate peace with Israel are the Jordanians. But the Jordanians don't have something very important going for them. They didn't fight in the Yom Kippur War, and therefore they didn't gain any territory in the Yom Kippur War. And since they didn't gain any territory, they have nothing to latch onto to bargain with. They want an Israeli withdrawal from the Jordan River, from the border, at least ever so slightly, give them something to work with, to justify making an agreement with Israel outside the context of a broader Arab-Israeli agreement. And Rabin doesn't budge. He refuses to budge with King Hussein, and as a result of that, 1974 becomes the year that who rises to power? Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat becomes an international figure of renown and respect as opposed to ill repute. What two things happened in 1974? Number one, he speaks at the United Nations General Assembly with a revolver in his pocket and an olive branch in the other one, and says, "Don't let me drop the olive branch, or else I'll start shooting." And everybody claps. You know, the communists, everything, they clap. The other thing is, at the Rabat conference, the Arab League decides that who is now the official representative of the residents of the West Bank and Gaza, no longer Jordan, but rather they are Palestinian, and the PLO are the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people. So you could argue that Rabin's intransigence with Hussein, despite American pressure to make some headway there, caused the advancement of the PLO. So we'll stop here. We'll stop